This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. On November 4th, the movement to demand that this nightmare must end, the Trump-Pence regime must go, began in the streets of two dozen cities all over the U.S. We're devoting this week's show to the resistance. Throughout the show, we'll be hearing audio clips from before or on November 4th to give you a little feeling for why people were marching and why it's so important. At the back end of the show, we'll hear an interview with Susan Loewenberg of the LA Theater Works talking about a play by Lillian Hellman, Watch on the Rhine, which will be staged in Los Angeles in 2018. The play contains powerful and important lessons for today, drawn from the anti-fascist struggles of the 1930s and 1940s. And opening up the show, we'll be hearing from Sansara Taylor of Refused Fascism. On November 4th, there were rallies in almost 24 cities across the country, and they're amounting to thousands of people coming out into the streets and saying, no, we refuse to accept the fascist in America, calling for the end of the Trump-Pence regime, driving them out. And joining us to talk about all this is Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a frequent guest on the show, and I'm always glad to have her on. She always brings a lot of light into things, and she is also one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism and a writer for RevCom.us. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. I'm so glad to be with you.
Great. Well, let's jump into this because we got so much to talk about. And having been at the march and the rally in Los Angeles, I was really very, very, very moved by it. And I felt it was really a good beginning. But let's start by giving people a sense of what happened on the 4th.
Yeah. So on November 4th, last Saturday, like you said, couple dozen cities and towns across this country, people took to the streets and launched a movement of sustained, growing, nonviolent mass political protest that has a very concrete and unifying demand. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. And this was, you know, it was a protest, but it was more than a protest. This was people coming forward and not just venting their anger and their frustration, but really defying fear, intimidation, threats, and slander to come out in the face of a fascist regime and the fascist mob that it has unleashed and whipped up to say, we recognize that, one, this is a fascist regime. It's not just a horrific collection of policies as bad as they are towards women, against Muslims, against immigrants, against the environment, towards war, but that there's a total package that is a qualitative change in the form of government that has to be stopped before it's locked in place, before it becomes too late, before the unspeakable becomes unstoppable. And that only the people acting together in our millions can end this nightmare and drive this regime from power. So November 4th, we launched. It was several thousand people across the country, a very important showing of people who were saying, yeah, we'll take that responsibility. We are going to move and be the thousands who reach out to and move tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and don't stop until we have millions and create a situation where this regime, the Trump-Pence regime, is removed from power. So it was very significant. It was a beautiful, joyful outpouring. It was a determined outpouring. It had different character around the country. Down in Austin, Texas, there was a protest, and this actually gets to the fascist character of what's happening in this country. There was over 200 militia, white supremacists, and armed counter-protesters trailing and following the Refused Fascism protest, but people came out anyhow, and they stood up and they defied this intimidation, and they marched and they held their rally. They had about 50 people down in Austin. It should have been thousands, but these ones who did step forward to demand the regime be removed were very courageous. And you know, in a place like New York, there was 1,500 people. It was a much bigger rally, but even that needs to get bigger. So it was, you know, it was small groupings in Indiana. It was big outpourings in Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco and Chicago. And it was a whole spectrum of people who were finding it within themselves, many of whom have never protested before in their lives, some of whom have. And to say that it's our responsibility to stop this fascist nightmare. And people took the first step.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you were just talking about with the fascists in Austin, one of the things that also happened up here in L.A., where there are a number of these fascists that came out and they were grouped up on a corner across the street, you know, from the march and the rally. But it was very evident that they were there with their chanting and their screaming and the police sort of blocking people off from supposedly going over and disrupting the fascists, you know, and they would say, oh, yeah, well, they were keeping them over there. But they were really mainly facing towards the rally itself. And the thing that I kept thinking about when you're talking about what happened in Austin, and after I read about that, I was also thinking about some of the things that actually happened here in LA, for instance, where people want, and I think it was probably true in many places, that there was this real sense, a shared sense of community and purpose, which was very, very important. People really had, you know, a lot of people in LA, for instance, that I talked to had come out, and before they got there, they were concerned, they were worried, they didn't know exactly what to do, but they felt they had to do something. And coming to this kind of demonstration, this kind of action, really was something that lifted them up, made them feel part of a community, and gave them purpose, which was also tied to how they even the fact that they looked at these Nazis and these people that came to disrupt or whatever, but people were there together. Even with all of the varied outlooks and views and everything else, the one thing that brought them together there was, the end of the Trump-Pence regime.
Yeah, I think, in some ways I think about what happened in Charlottesville with the white supremacists who rallied there and then the violence that they inflicted on dozens and dozens of people and the murder of Heather Heyer, which was horrific. And then Donald Trump's response, refusing to condemn them in a very plain-spoken and straightforward way, and instead insisting that he saw very fine people among those white supremacists chanting Nazi slogans and carrying torches. And I think this was a moment that a lot of people started to see in a way that they had not seen yet, another dimension of why we call this a fascist regime. What it's unleashing, the ugly, unvarnished white supremacy and anti-Semitism and violence and misogyny and all of this, and the sanction that this has been given from the highest office in the land. So they looked at this, and on the one side, it was a wake-up call, but at the same time, people saw, wow, there are stakes going up against that. It requires risk. It requires courage. It requires sacrifice. These fascists are serious, and I mean that the fascists on the street, but I also mean that even more the fascists in power. You know, Donald Trump threatening to, revoke licenses from major media outlets, threatening to imprison his political opponents, still working to get investigations opened up against Hillary, and if he can do that against Hillary, what does that say about the vengeance and the punitive character of how he's going to treat everybody, including people who don't have so much backing? And I think there was both a wake-up call and a real fear instilled. And we in Refuse Fascism faced a tremendous disinformation campaign, a campaign of lies, a campaign of conspiracy and fake news that was spread throughout the alt-right media networks and then echoed on Fox News. And then this unleashed a dynamic of thousands and thousands of threats that we received and the mobilization of fascists counter-protesting where we held our events in at least six cities in massive and organized numbers, not massive, but organized forces, and then other places in more loose-knit, almost everywhere there was Trump supporters and fascist counter-protesters. And I think this is, it took courage for people to come out. And it was very important. But then it's true what you said. When people got out on the street together, I was just reading these reports from Austin, Texas, where people said, I was nervous. I had nerves all morning. I was scared. I drove to Austin. And as soon as we got there together, even though we were surrounded by all these fascists and armed militias and people with machetes and rifles and Confederate flags and all the rest, they said, once we were there together and we were standing up and we were speaking, we had humanity in our hearts, all of humanity, the 7 billion people on this planet whose future is imperiled by the regime currently in power. And we had a lot of strength. We knew we were part of a movement, and we knew we speak for millions and we represent the hope of billions. And I say this because other people, the whole point of the fourth, it was a beginning. Other people have to join this movement. It has to grow. Our answer to the intimidation and the threats has to be to defy that and grow our numbers and grow our strength and grow our community with the demand that this nightmare must end. We refuse to allow a future that is governed by these white supremacists, these women haters, these misogynists, this man who's stomping his way, Donald Trump stomping his way through Asia as we speak, who has threatened fire and fury like the world has never seen. He went into, when he was standing in Japan, the place, the only place where nuclear weapons have been dropped on civilians, which the U.S. did, incinerating two major cities, killing hundreds of thousands. He stood there and he said, look, in the past, sometimes nations have underestimated us, and it hasn't been too pleasant for them. Wink, wink. And he's threatening the world with nuclear annihilation, a nuclear holocaust. Right now you have military experts who are saying, very, very informed people on this, who are saying that they're estimating the likelihood in the near future of a major war in North Korea, the U.S. against North Korea, being anywhere from 20% likelihood that that's about to be near to begin in near time, to 50% likelihood. This is very, very dangerous. And so people, I'm saying this to laud and uphold and celebrate the courage and the beauty and the morality and the righteousness of those who stood up with the demand that the whole regime must go, with the recognition we can't just wait it out 4 years. We can't, you know, try to mitigate this. We have to drive this regime out. But also with the challenge to others who didn't come out. RefuseFascism.org is a movement that is for everybody, and it needs to grow. And the whole vision, and this came through, it was a beautiful, there was a keynote speech that was given at almost all of these rallies everywhere with the diverse different groups of people that really laid forward a vision of launching on November 4th and then continuing with daily protests and actions and organizing mass outreach and meetings and speak-outs and walk-outs and building day after day and really coming back with even greater numbers this Saturday, November 11th, against any new war or nuclear aggression in North Korea or against Iran, and once again raising even more the demand in the name of humanity. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. This regime must go. And then in 2 weeks, on November 18th, even more people coming back to make the demand. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. And the idea is that it snowballs, that it builds. And from there, after these 2 weeks of pushing and mobilizing and coming back, we want to get to a place where we have tens of thousands. And, you know, we had about 3,000 or 4,000 across the country on November 4th. We want tens of thousands. And we want to then go forward to gather hundreds of thousands, to have a new platform to step off from, because this regime is deadly serious. And we have to move heaven and earth to drive them out. And only the people can do that. And we are the ones who have to go out and reach those people, organize those people, and show up on November 11th, on November 18th, across this country.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism, and she writes for RevCom.us. Now, Sansara, exactly the thing that you were just talking about, because that was one of the things that really struck me, is that, you know, people came into this, and for a lot of people it was like they weren't used to coming out into the streets. They weren't used to coming out to a march like that. And particularly, you know, when they were looking at sort of, you know, what's happened since Trump came around, and some, you know, younger people, but other people as well, people who, you know, had thought, you know, their careers, and they just, that's what they paid attention to. But they found themselves in the streets on Saturday. And that was, to me, there was something really significant about that in terms of the emergence of an actual movement that's going to take this thing on. People really came in with all kinds of different ideas, but they came committed to making a stand, and then things were brought to them that a lot of people were wrestling with. And it was really significant when that went off on the march. While not everybody who was at the rally went on the march, four-fifths of the people did. And then among the other people, they stayed around and they were talking with each other, and they were signing up to be gotten hold of. And you could see stacks of, you know, like 12-inch stacks of papers where people had written their names, get hold of me, get hold of me. And it really was a remarkable sort of, you could see a remarkable birth of something much bigger than had existed before and very significant.
Yeah, you know, I was just reading some of the reports and the texture of what happened around the country. And you know, there were people who drove 200 miles they heard about these protests. There was people who drove 200 miles to go to the nearest protest that they could get to. There were people who drove across Ohio 40 miles. A woman brought her 7-year-old kid and came and joined a protest that was probably a couple dozen people. It was not big, but was so, you know, surrounded by Trump country and Trump supporters. And had never been to a protest before. There was a woman from Indiana. There was groups of people who came out who didn't know each other. One put up an event on Facebook and called for this. And all her friends kept saying, "You're so brave. You're so brave. I can't believe you're doing this." And all of her family supports Trump, and all the people around her support Trump. And somebody, you know, a dozen or so people came and they met each other, and they said it was the most beautiful thing. And they had a dozen counter protesters. But this was people. Now it's small. It was small, but it was a beginning, and I think that this is one of the things that needs to be understood. There are millions and millions of people who are sick at heart. There are millions of people who still have not recovered from that horrific day a year ago when we all stayed up late at night or woke up the next morning to the nightmare of Donald Trump claiming the victory of the election. And if you were more outraged a year ago when you first heard that than you are today, then the normalization is having an effect on you, and it's dulling your sense of urgency. But I think almost everybody, if you're honest with yourself, you know in your gut that a man who stands up there and threatens fire and fury like the world has never seen, that says, "I want to completely destroy a country of 25 million people," you know, that a man who sees fine people marching among white supremacists, or calls, you know, black NFL players who protest the murder of black people by police, curses them out and speaks of them the way a slave master would speak about black people. The people know this is not normal, and this should not be allowed. And that part of you know, that part of you, everybody listening, that part of you, there's millions more who have that part of them. And that can matter, or it can be crusted over and become complicity. And, you know, right now, I just want to speak very frankly. There's a lot of good German culture being built up, a lot of normalization, a lot of, "Oh, we don't like this, but getting on with life," a lot of, you know, hoping that somebody's going to take care of this, and frankly, gambling, and hoping that Trump doesn't follow through on exactly who he's told us he is, and gambling with the future of and the lives of people all over the planet. And yet, you had exactly what you were describing, Michael. People did come out, and they found each other, and they connected, and we had, you know, very big differences among us, and that too is a positive thing, because that's a strength. There's room for differences. We can learn from each other. We celebrate our diversity as we stand together against a fascist America. And I'm giving the examples of the people driving hundreds of miles, or coming out in the face of armed militias, or coming and finding the courage to stand together, because there are millions out there. We have to move urgently. We have to organize. RefuseFascism.org is recognizing the urgency of the situation, that we must drive this regime from power, but also the possibility of that in this massive numbers of people who are upset, who are outraged, who are sick at heart, who are terrified. And that's the sleeping giant. It's not the Democratic Party that's going to stop Trump. It is not Mueller's investigation that's going to stop Trump. It certainly won't absent a mass upsurge from below. The divisions among the rulers, Bob Corker calling out Donald Trump, the Democrats and their differences with Trump, even the investigation, all that could become part of how this regime gets removed from power, but not without a demand from below. Mm-hmm. And that's what's missing, and that's what Refuse Fascism and everybody, you know, everybody who doesn't want a fascist America, that's the way we move right now. That's the way we can change and remove this regime from power.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that really got me too is that, again, just this based on what I was doing Saturday in terms of going around and talking to a lot of people that were at the rally and then on the march. And one of the things I found that was really encouraging was the numbers of young people, students and younger people, because this whole point of, you know, what you were saying, it's sort of like there's people that, you know, were sort of whatever, you know, they were hesitant, or they just began to dig things out, and they kind of came to this, and they're bringing a lot of, you know, their own opinions, which is good. And then you had a lot of these students who came and were just like, damn, man, we are just going to get out in the streets and we are going to stand here and we're not. And you had that sense of a new generation of people who weren't going to settle for this and who were looking at this whole opportunity as this whole event as being an opportunity to step off in the way that needs to be stepped off in.
I think this is really precious and very important. And the students, the youth, they need to be part of, there's never been a movement that has changed history, that's challenged anything that's entrenched and oppressive, whether it was Jim Crow or the Vietnam War or the Iraq War or rape culture or, the homophobia and bigotry. None of this has ever been challenged and beaten back without students and young people being a very, very vital part of it. And I think it's very precious that there was young people out there. They need to find each other. They need to network. They need to take, we need chapters of Refuse Fascism on the campuses, and people who are part of other groups need to partner with this movement. And really, this needs to be something that a generation takes up in a very big way. So I'm glad to hear that, and I want to really, there was students out in New York and in other cities, too. I really want to encourage and give backing to those who step forward and encourage them to go and struggle with your peers and give them a way into this and be part of this movement. I think there's a lot of, one thing we found on the campuses, and we found this in society too, is that there's a lot of disgust with Trump, but there's still, people don't understand the depth of what he's already done and what he intends to do. In a lot of ways, and frankly, this happened with Hitler, too. A lot of ways, people and the media does this, and I'm not blaming the youth for it, but it has an impact on the youth. There's a lot of ridiculing the idiocy and the buffoonery and mocking Trump rather than really taking him seriously and taking him at his word. He's, I saw this guy the other day when John Kelly, got out and upheld Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general. Upheld the man who led people to kill and die to defend chattel slavery, a white supremacist genocidal institution. And John Kelly comes out and upholds the man, and all these talking heads come out and say, well, either John Kelly doesn't know history, or he's pandering to the base. And none of them would entertain the fact that actually he does know history, and he's upholding white supremacy, and it's intentional. And he's known, and the same with Trump. And so that has an effect on people. People pretend like maybe Trump's just stupid, So I think this, there's a need to take the substance. RefuseFascism.org has done a lot of documentation of the actual scope of the crimes this regime has carried out against immigrants, against Muslims, against women and LGBTQ people, against the environment, against civil liberties, and against the people of the world. And to bring that and diffuse the disgust that a lot of the students feel with a deeper understanding of what this regime is actually doing and the urgency and the huge role that students and young people have to play in turning this around and inspiring other sections of society to stand up.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I have just a couple more questions. And one was, and this is, something, a lot of people, when you're at a rally, a lot of people, sometimes they pay attention to speeches, sometimes they don't. Sometimes people are talking and arguing or doing whatever. But during this one, I was really moved by this. And I don't know if it was true in every place that, that there was a rally, but it was really true here that a lot of people, and because I was going around trying to talk to people, and people would say, wait a minute, I want to hear this, And it was sort of like there was this point of the speech brought something new to people. It really helped people, the way it was, the way it was produced, what it was saying, but also just what it was saying really drew people's attention, where people were actually looking at this as we need to understand what's going down, and this is actually opening a door. And I thought that was something important to note.
Yeah, I would encourage people to go to refusefascism.org and to read the keynote speech that was given at all the rallies, because I do think people came out for really good reasons, but people know we're up against a real monster that's very entrenched, and that it's not, it's not like, oh, they're going to say, oh, I guess people don't like what we're doing. Okay, we'll change. They know that Trump and Pence and Sessions and the whole John Kelly, all of them are they're bullies, and they knock over opponents, and they lash out, and they and they're stomping all over the rule of law and the political norms and international relations. And so I think there was a hunger and an appetite and a real appreciation for the fact that refusefascism.org put out an actual strategy and vision. And I would say a path to victory, you know, a viable path to victory, not a guarantee, but a vision of moving from thousands to tens of thousands to millions to create a situation where the divisions that do exist in the power structure actually become the cracks widen and become the vehicle through which the regime is forced from power. But that doesn't happen without this massive demand from below. And this was laid out in the speech and how we move together and how people can take this up in different ways. And then speaking very frankly about the courage that's required and why it's worth it and the morality that fuses us together and why it's worth it and why it can make all the difference in the world. And I really, you know, I'm hinting at it, and you're describing the impact of it on the crowd, but I would encourage people to go to refusefascism.org and to read the speech, because it does provide a lot of direction, and this movement is serious. It's not just a, you know, people like to be dismissive, and there's a culture in the society that says, oh, protest, that's just people out there throwing a tantrum. Oh, a protest, it doesn't make any difference. They wouldn't spend so much time demeaning it and dismissing it if it wasn't something that had so much potential power. But then this is more than just one protest. And the speech also speaks about, you know, what happened in South Korea last year and earlier this year, which was a months-long struggle, but it was actually a movement, a mass nonviolent movement of people who kept coming back and kept coming back and grew from thousands to millions and amassed in the streets and created a political crisis where their president was impeached, forced from power, put up on criminal charges. And it wouldn't have happened without the struggle. And we here know it's not South Korea, we're a different country, but the stakes are even higher. And the depth of outrage is even deeper. And the potential is there. And the only reason it won't be realized is if we sit back and wait. And we're determined not to allow that to happen. And because of that, there's a way for everybody, even if you're very new, even if you've never been an organizer before. That's my point about the stories of people who drove and hooked up, you know, for their first time in Indiana or you know, Ohio or other places around the country where there were protests. Because refusefascism.org has forged this movement, there's a vehicle for everybody to join with.
Yeah, exactly.
And people who are brand new can make a huge difference. And people who've been in this struggle, who've maybe been focused on immigrant rights or around LGBTQ issues or around one issue or another, the fact is, under fascism, you're going to be fighting on shrinking ground, and everybody knows this. Everybody feels this. You know, you can't defend all the immigrants who are being rounded up. Every single immigrant rights group is doing important and righteous work, and is completely overwhelmed by the tsunami of assault that's happening and the lives being destroyed. And only if we join together. Keep doing that work, but join with this movement to drive the whole regime out. Whatever other struggle you're part of, you need to partner with this movement. Our futures are bound up together, and there's only one way that we get a world that has the potential to be decent for humanity, and that is by coming together to drive this regime out.
Yeah, definitely. Now, one more quick question, which is this, and if you were beginning to speak to it right now. Again, the march, the rally and march, the end of it wasn't a conclusion, but the beginning of a whole new phase of struggle. So I want you to repeat and tell people about this, the serious need to build on the momentum of November 4th. Let's talk about concretes, but also just what needs to happen.
Yeah, so November 4th was the launch of a two-week sort of a campaign within a campaign. 2 weeks of really intensive continuing to go back out with daily protests, daily speakouts, different kinds of political mobilizations. In Los Angeles, they have a calendar, and in San Francisco, there's a calendar, and in New York, there's a calendar, and in Cleveland, it's a calendar. You know, no one wants to listen to me recite every activity in every part of the country all week long. That's at refusefascism.org. But the idea is to intensely organize over these 2 weeks to build. We had 3,000 or 4,000 across the country, which is a good beginning, but it's just a beginning. But to build off of that and to come back. We're coming out every day, including on the anniversary of Trump's election. There's actions planned around the country that Recuse Fascism is going to be part of. But then especially November 11th, which is a Saturday. It's a day a lot of people can come out. This is a day, you know, I go back to Trump being in Asia and threatening nuclear annihilation against the Korean Peninsula, threatening war. You know, today the advisors are saying, all the news is saying, oh, he toned down his threats. He told the South Koreans things are going to be okay. Well, he could tweet tomorrow, and that whole thing could be, nobody should trust that this guy is backing away from his threats of war. And so we are coming out November 11th all over the country. Find your city at refusefascism.org. And if there's nothing planned where you are, then plan something and send it to us. We'll put it on the website to say no war, no nukes, no fire and fury in North Korea and Iran. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. We're coming back on the Saturday with that demand. And then 2 weeks, you know, the following week, November 18th, which would be the end of the two-week period, we want to amass even more for everybody who came out on the 4th to bring 10 friends, for people who are learning about it for the first time to come out, to bring your congregations, to bring your organizations, to bring your community groups, your student group, to bring your friends, and to have, like I said, tens of thousands, many more times people than we had on the 4th, so that this is a snowballing effect, and that will launch us into the Thanksgiving and holiday period with greater momentum, and from there we'll launch a new wave of struggle that goes even higher. We're in this until we win it. We are not stopping until this regime is driven from power. We're not just trying to be out there tolling the bell hoping somebody listens. We have to be growing, and the engine to that growth is everybody who has stepped forward into this movement is part of going out to get more people.
All right, Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for this.
Okay, Michael, it's always a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much.
You too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I've just been talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org, Refuse Fascism, Drive Out the Trump-Pence Regime, and she's also a writer for RevCom.us. As I said at the beginning, we're going to hear some of the voices of November 4th, both before and on the day. So let's give a listen.
Hello, my name is Michael Shannon, and I pledge to support and join in the protest that will begin November 4th and continue day after day until this demand is met. The Trump-Pence regime must go. The future of the world depends on it. Let's stand together with courage and conviction, overcome fear and uncertainty, and let the world know that we refuse to accept a fascist America. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
Technique. Thank you very much. I think it's important to have some context about how we got here. A long time ago, when we were told that we would have a liberal president under Obama, we continued under imperialistic policies. And now we're surprised when we planted the seeds of despotism at our own door. There's still no health care. There's still no human rights. People are still blind to the fact that we've begun wars that have no end in sight. We've ignored the issues at home, and the issues abroad have gotten worse, and the issues at home haven't gotten any better. In terms of unity, we're at an all-time low because people can't even decide what the violation of human rights are, because people can't even tell you who's a human being or not. They tell you some people are aliens. We're not aliens. We're not from space. We're other human beings that were involved in a war with the United States of America who took their territory. We're indigenous people. And at the end of the day, we have to admit certain things to ourselves, that Columbus never discovered America. Indigenous people discovered Columbus lost its sea. That this country was built by a multitude of people, but when we say this country was built by immigrants or our immigrants are everywhere, yes, there are immigrants that came to this country, but there were also people that were forcibly taken to this country, and there were people whose land this already was a long time ago. And I really, really do appreciate the fact that we're finally having a conversation about the truth, and that people were enslaved. They were not slaves. There's no person who's born a slave. We're all born free human beings. They went through a process of dehumanization in slavery. And now we're finally discussing that history, and I appreciate that we have an honest conversation amongst ourselves. We need health care, because even the people that are angry and disagree with us, treatment too.
That was actor Michael Shannon taking the pledge for November 4th and hip-hop artist, poet, and activist Immortal Technique speaking at the rally in New York. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Hail to the Chief from Prophets of Rage.
I'm the priest here at the Church of the Epiphany in Los Angeles. We all know what has been happening to our nation since this Trump-Pence regime took office in January. There's been an increase in violence, an increase in hatred, an increase in injustice, and they are systematically despoiling our environment, our financial system, and victimizing the poor day after day after day. There is only one way, there is only one way for us to bring justice and bring tolerance back to our national life, and that is for us to protest, to hit the streets, and to demand the removal of this regime this coming November 4th. We are all coming out into the streets, people of faith, people of conscience, and we are going to stay there until this regime is removed. So I'm asking you to join with me as a matter of conscience to help bring our national life back to a life of justice, to the highest ideals on which this nation was founded. Come with me November 4th. I'll be there, and so should you.
That was Reverend Tom Carey from the Church of the Epiphany in Los Angeles. Now we'll be hearing an interview I did with Susan Loewenberg of the LA Theater Works. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. Her name is Susan Loewenberg. And she is the producer of the LA Theater Works production of a play by Lillian Hellman. It was an incredible play. It was Watch on the Rhine. I wanted to talk to Susan because the questions that were posed there for me when I saw this, it just knocked me back in my seat. And the person I went to see it with, we just couldn't stop talking about it. It raised questions that really I think everybody's got to be wrestling with today. So I'm just going to jump into it right now. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're the director of the LA Theater Works.
Producing director,
yes. Okay, and you do a great job.
I did not direct Watch on the Rhine, but I sort of run the whole organization.
Right, right. And you have an opinion about Watch on the Rhine, right?
I certainly do.
Good, good, really good. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you right away, when I saw this play, and it really is, folks, I have to tell you, it's something that just, it's amazing what you see when you see this play. It's really something that grabs you, and it grabs you for all kinds of reasons. We were looking at the similarities between then and now. This play was happening in, 1941, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the approach of war and all the things that were the rise of, you know, the fascistic things that were happening when the play was written was actually, was it written in 41?
It premiered in 1941, mm-hmm. and it actually had about 378 performances on Broadway. And then it was optioned for a film because it was seen as something that could be a very patriotic piece and very useful during World War II. And so it was made into a film written by Lillian Hellman's lover, the famous Dashiell Hammett. He wrote the screenplay. And they cast Betty Davis in the role of the daughter, Sarah. It actually wasn't the starring role, but they kind of made it into the starring role because Betty Davis was the biggest name in the film.
Mm-hmm. I read there were some other things, too, where it had a little bit of a rocky launch, and then the actors in it actually volunteered to work for either free or for less than their salary because they saw the importance of this play, which I thought was actually well worn out. But when I saw the LA Theater Works version of it, it was just, you know, like I said, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you right away was because it just poses these big questions for us all today that we need to be dealing with. And one of the things is you went into it and you made a decision. You guys made a decision to have this particular play now. And, you know, this timely reminder to keep our eyes open, to remain vigilant and involved. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I think the message of the play, Watch on the Rhine, which sadly isn't done very much, and the reason, it's a kind of a silly reason, but it's actually a reason that affects regional theaters around the country. There are three young children in the play, and they are 9, 11, and 13. So if you take this on, you know, you have to deal with having three young kids and tutors, and it becomes very, very complicated. And sadly, that, I think, is the reason the play isn't done more. I wanted to do the play, which I actually saw at the Arena Stage Theater in Washington several months ago, starring Marsha Mason. I was struck by the fact, I mean, I'm a fan of Lillian Hellman, and I've done a number of her plays, but I was struck by the fact that this play right now has a message which is so important for us, which is don't sit on the sidelines. You mustn't sit on the sidelines, and you mustn't be in denial. And that is something that I think Lillian Hellman was eager to communicate. You know, America was quite isolationist, and there were many, many people, of course, who did not want to get involved in World War II. And Franklin Roosevelt, of course, had a very difficult time convincing the public that this was something that we needed to get involved in. And so I think in many ways, she wrote the play as a kind of cautionary tale.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, because that's exactly what I was thinking in terms of the questions that are posed by this play, and that they are the things that confront a lot of people today, the comfortable niche versus the future of humanity and the planet, which really is the big thing. That's what's actually was posed very directly and very concretely without using, you know, it doesn't go into a lot of preaching or something like that. But what you're hit with is the people in the play have a choice to make between whether they settle in a comfortable niche or they actually stand up and do something that's really for the importance of all of humanity.
Well, I think the play is, if you think about it, the play opens in this beautiful Washington mansion with this seemingly perfect family, with a woman who is a kind of Pamela Harriman type character, and they have a lovely existence. And the idea of that, I think, is to contrast it with, you know, this incredibly comfortable, ample setting, and contrasting it with what is going on in Europe, what is so desperately happening there. And it's meant, I think, to be, she did that very, very deliberately. She set those two things up in opposition. And when her daughter come in the play, her daughter is coming back from Europe after having been away for 20 years. She has married in Europe. She's got three children. And Fanny, the matron, has not seen her family in most of that time. So it's a very exciting time. And she and her son, David, live in this beautiful mansion surrounded by servants. And they're finally going, you know, the daughter is coming home. And, of course, that homecoming brings Europe, brings the desperation, the desperate times into this serene household.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really the way the drama of the play is played out. It's those two things that are happening. And the play starts out, you think the play is a very sunny, cheerful, you're not sure what it is. Is it a bit of a comedy? What is it? Is it just a domestic, family, pleasant play? And of course, the play turns halfway through incredibly dark.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see the darkness from abroad come into this family and pose moral, ethical questions, emotional questions for the family, asking the people in this family to make life and death decisions.
You know, it's interesting. It's very heavy because what it comes down to, and I thought about this a lot because, you know, there's all kinds of commentaries on this. And Hellman herself, I mean, she was really an interesting person. And when she went before the House Un-American Activities Committee, she wasn't one of these, like, people that folded up and said, oh, well, you know, either just crawled away or gave everybody to the committees or whatever. She said, I'm not going to cut my conscience to fit this year's fashions, which was kind of, you know, a very good stand to be taking in the face of this, you know, sort of fascistic committee that was, you know, champing down on everything. But one of the things, too, and it's funny because when you're talking about this, I read a review, one of the original reviews of it in the New York Times, and it said, Hellman never preaches. She's given fascism a terrible appearance without introducing a uniform or a party salute. And I kept thinking about that, and I thought about it in relation to what I felt at the end of the play, which was, ideologically, this was one of the strongest and most important plays I've seen, where it actually called on people to step up when humanity is confronted with immense evil and act accordingly against it. And I thought that was a really incredibly powerful, that whole last part of the play was just incredibly powerful and had a really important message to deliver to people today.
Yeah, it did. And it actually, you know, the message was do stuff. Because in the end, they all did the right thing. And it was a very hard thing to do because they all became complicit in a very dangerous and what some people might say was a morally very complicated, if not wrong, act, which was an act of murder. You know, they ended up all participating in it, but the feeling was that this was absolutely justified. And so it presents a lot of complicated questions about, you know, how far will you go to stand up for what you think is right? What will you do? You know, each person in the play has to confront a very serious issue, which could have very, very, very serious consequences for everyone. And so it's not an easy play for many reasons. And it as a film, they struggled again because there was at that time, film production was very tightly controlled. There was something called the Hays Office. And things that were considered in any way morally compromising, or they had very rigid rules about what could be shown on the screen and so on. And there was a question at the end in the film. The Hays Office objected to the fact that Kurt, who is the anti-fascist figure in the play, Sarah's husband, kills somebody who is a Nazi collaborator, and he gets away with it. And the Hays Office actually objected to it and wanted to have them change the ending so that Kurt, in the end, would be killed. And Lillian Hellman absolutely refused and objected, and they backed down.
All right. That's important. That's a really good one. And on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. But Susan, I really want to thank you very much for joining us today and for that play.
Thank you so much.
All right. We've just been talking with Susan Lohnberg, who's the executive producing director of the LA Theater Works, and it's a nonprofit media arts and theater organization. We're now going to hear two more clips. The first is a poem by Nakisha X on driving out the Trump-Pence regime. The second is the trailer for The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And that's a new talk by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The film is available at revcom.us.
A poem against the Trump-Pence regime called In the Name of Humanity. They march with torches and Nazi flags, with American patriotism dripping from their lips. They brag on how many sons of bitches they've killed while running over activists in the streets. Their red, white, and blue sheets, screams of black and brown blood wiped clean by police brutality, deportation, and denying gays employment. Their philosophy is hate. The Trump-Pence regime will make America great by fueling hate and shaming Puerto Rican victims of the hurricane, demanding that they wipe their stains of laziness and debt while throwing paper towels at them with no regard or respect for their humanity. Insanity of white men who don't want to be replaced, so dick-shaped rusty pipes are driven into the blood and soil of the sacred lands of the indigenous. Rescinded Obama's clean power plan, because restricting carbon emissions from power plants to them is just too much rigidness. So welcome to Trump's America. Oh yes, it's getting scarier. He wants to destroy not only America, but Korea, banning Muslim people, mistaking Sharia as terrorist law when it means right action, not to be confused with his alt-right cabinet of Christian fascists, slashing women and LGBTQ rights, promising to overturn Roe versus Wade because women are slaves who can't decide what to do with their own pussies. So we should stay silent and let him freely grab them. While Betsy DeVos raves on the Department of Education, rolling back investigations on civil rights abuses against women, people of color, and gays. The only people Trump backs is blue. Sessions making it harder for victims of police brutality to sue. Reducing aid to poor families on health care, and instead of public education, they advocating for religious fundamental charter schools. After Trump's election, there was a resurgence of lynching nooses that began appearing around the country and at schools. Our rights are being strangled under the star spangled of right-wing fascist humanity dangles on a noose. We must ignite the passion of human beings to demand that this Trump-Pence backwards regime be driven from power. The clock strikes and every hour could be our last. November the 4th demands that this horrible past of a so-called great America will finally fall, along with white supremacy, police brutality, and that fake-ass border wall. We demand an end to the Trump-Pence regime, and we demand real justice and freedom for all.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime, relentlessly assaulting civil rights and liberties and openly promoting bigotry and inequality. This has caused disgust, anger, and agonizing among huge numbers of people. And there have been many important acts of resistance, big and small, to the continuing outrages committed by this regime and its supporters. But the regime remains in power and is determined to ride roughshod over all obstacles to carry out its monstrous agenda. And the need for a massive outpouring of people, acting together nonviolently but with sustained determination to create a political situation where this regime cannot remain in power, cries out. The organization Refuse Fascism, refusefascism.org, has put forward a call and a plan and is actively building for that mass mobilization to begin on November 4. So this poses sharply the immediate urgent challenge we face. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself. It used to be a common saying To the person of the right, order is more important than justice, while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals, and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program? Whether we consider ourselves revolutionaries, convinced of the need for a radical overturning of the system and thorough transformation of society, or we believe that it is possible to bring about changes that will lead to a more just society within this system. Whether our understanding is that America is not and cannot be a force for good in the world, or we hope it still can become that, all of us need to come together and act together with the urgency that corresponds to the terrible present and the gravely imperiled future that this fascist regime represents for humanity, and with the conviction that something far better is necessary and possible. Thousands must be organized to take to the streets in cities all over the country, beginning on November 4, overcoming fear and feeling the strength of their common cause and action and their common aspiration and determination, making clear their resolve to not just make a statement, but to continue, and more than that, to spread and multiply their numbers and impact until millions have been mobilized and refuse to stop until the demand has been met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor and Susan Loewenberg. And I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.